gives me great pleasure to introduce Karen Crosby. She is Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Warwick. Her research is focused on issues of gender, technology, and the body, and she's the author of When IVF Fails, Feminism, Infertility, and Negotiation of Normality. Her current research has taken her into obesity surgery, which she's going to talk to us about today. So if I can turn it over to Karen.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me to come and talk today, and thank you for coming. This is a kind of work in progress, so I think there's some elements of it that aren't quite kind of coming together right yet, and I'd really appreciate feedback on that. Okay, so as I'm sure everyone here is more than aware already, rising obesity rates are widely perceived as... Ooh, that's not working. Hold on a second. How do you... Ah, it's just slow. Okay. Widely perceived as constituting a public health crisis of epidemic proportions and against which action must be taken. I'm sure you're probably familiar with the Foresight Report, which is the sort of most recent sort of round of this sort of sense of alarm around obesity. At the beginning of the 21st century, this action became increasingly conceptualized in militaristic terms. It's obviously just slow. As a war on obesity. This is the tabloid version of the Foresight Report. Taking the form of a proliferating raft of programs and interventions aimed at the prevention, treatment, and management of obesity, and by extension, those who are medically categorized as obese or deemed to be at risk of becoming so. So that would be just about everybody, as in deemed to be at risk. However, this raft of interventions doesn't take the form of a sort of smorgasbord of options from which to freely choose. Instead, there's an escalating hierarchy of interventions, with access to each determined by documented failure, particularly within the NHS, documented failure with the preceding intervention. So you have to go through them in order and prove that you've failed. So these begin with lifestyle and educational programs, then supervised low-calorie and very low-calorie diets, weight loss pharmaceuticals, and finally, obesity surgery. And I just put this in. This is a flyer that actually just came through my mum's door, that someone just put through with the pizza leaflets, an ad for obesity, which is a kind of delightful irony in itself. This latter, obesity surgery, refers to a constellation of surgical interventions into the fat body, which aim to reduce stomach capacity and or intestinal length in order to limit the body's capacity to consume and absorb food. It's difficult to get precise statistics about the surgery rates in the UK, but in a recent press release about NHS provision of surgery, the British Obesity Surgery Patients Association, or BOSPA, estimated that approximately 3,000 operations will be funded by the NHS in this financial year, an increase of 50% from 2 years ago. Furthermore, NHS-funded surgery is estimated to account for about half of all obesity surgeries in the UK, so it's probably at around 6,000, and that's an underestimate almost for sure, because the survey is very inaccurate. They had quite a low response rate. Though this 6,000 marks a significant rise over the 4,300 surgeries estimated to have been performed in 2005, so we've got this kind of this real incremental increase. Press release from BOSPA again in 2005 notes that they receive 3,000 to 4,000 inquiries a month about surgery. So there's this unmet demand. And it also signals, I think, the increasingly mainstream status of obesity surgery. It's also worth noting, I'm not going to talk about the gendering of it today, but 80% or more of all obesity surgeries are performed on women. So there's another element to it, which I don't want to go into, but is kind of worth discussing in its own right. The surgeries themselves differ in terms of their precise function, the extent to which stomach and intestine are bypassed or removed, and in terms of the degree to which they can be reversed or revised. And I'm going to kind of generalise across surgeries rather than talking about specific ones. But one of the ways we can generalise is to say that all obesity surgeries involve risk and are associated with a range of acute and chronic side effects, including infection, vomiting, diarrhea, gastrointestinal tract problems, malnutrition, and in a very small number of cases, death. Thank you. It's also worth noting, and this is from a couple of years ago, but she's described as a 25-year-old who was desperate to be slim, and it tends to get tagged as an exercise of extreme vanity in some newspapers, which I would say is a misrepresentation of the surgery. Relative paucity of long-term statistics about surgery means that it's very difficult to assess the precise nature of the risk. But the Swedish obesity subject study, for example, reports a mortality rate of 0.25%, While a study in the US by Flume et al. In 2005 reported a 2% mortality rate at 30 days post-surgery, rising to 4.6% after a year. And they also noted it's much higher for people who are over 65 and where the surgeons have a much lower surgical volume. So the more you do, the kind of the higher the success rates are. The Swedish study also found that 13% of patients had post-operative complications, and in 2.2% of cases, these were so serious that they required reoperation. Significantly, even a successful and uncomplicated surgery and recovery routinely involves side effects such as vomiting. Indeed, this is viewed by both patients and practitioners not necessarily as a problem at all, but rather as evidence that the surgery is working. So if you eat too much, it won't go through the narrowed stomach until you throw up. But in addition to and concurrent with the risks and the problems of coping with some of the more problematic effects of it, like being sick, obesity surgery offers the possibility of a dramatic and sustainable weight loss for those who are experiencing extreme and intractable obesity. I'm very concerned about the use of before and after photographs because they tend to disguise what happens in the middle and the problems. But I just wanted to show this, that I've got his permission to use this. This is the man who founded the website that I recruited the participants in my study from. His name's Ken. And this is his from the leaflet of the organisation. I mean, I'm really just showing this to show that it can produce this quite dramatic change. Statistically, the chances of sustained weight loss are much higher with surgery than with other methods such as diet, exercise or drugs. The Swedish obesity subject study, for example, found a 23.4% reduction in weight 2 years post-surgery against a 0.1 increase in weight for the control group who were using dieting and so on. After 10 years, the surgery group showed a 16.1% decrease from starting weight, while the control group showed an increase of 1.6%. The ubiquitous before and after images that populate magazines and the promotional materials of private providers compound this sense of hope around surgery. And you may have seen her; she was on a TV documentary about the hospital group. The thing about surgery is that when it works, it really works, contributing to this really dramatic, highly visible, socially valued bodily transformation. Okay. This bodily transformation offers the possibility of increased mobility, improved well-being, and freedom from the social exclusion, harassment, and discrimination to which those who are visibly large are routinely subjected. Obesity surgery, therefore, for all its risks, is also a technology of profound hope. In spite of its increasingly mainstream status, and perhaps because of it, obesity surgery is a highly contested intervention. For some, it's a risky but medically necessary step into the fat body. For others, it's seen as a morally problematic quick fix for those who are unwilling to perform the normative disciplining of the body through the morally privileged strategies of diet and exercise. And for a small minority, such as size activist Marilyn Wan, it's nothing short of, quote, the mutilation of healthy body parts, close quote, in the service of a fat-phobic society. And she sees it very much as violence, specifically against women. But in this paper, rather than adjudicating between these different interpretations and positions on surgery, I want to think about what kind of solution obesity surgery is and what its role is in the wider context of the war on obesity. In particular, I want to argue that surgery can be understood as both inseparable from the war on obesity and its associated values, and at the same time as a critical commentary on its practical limitations. As such, it can be understood as both a technology of hope and a technology of hopelessness. But I also suggest that the experience of surgery as a technology of hope is a very mixed blessing for those engaging with it, since it easily makes those who engage with it unsuccessful. Those who engage with it unsuccessfully as responsible for its failures. Okay, so when hope fails, it's usually put down to the patients rather than the surgery. I'll talk more about that later. So I'm going to briefly discuss the methodology of the study that I'm drawing on, and then I'm going to argue that fundamentally, obesity surgery is a very different order of intervention from any of the technologies that precede it. I argue that these differences create space for the participants in my study to rebut the suggestion that they are responsible for past failures in weight management and allow them to position themselves not as the denigrated objects of the war on obesity, but as its dedicated subjects. And so this enables them to create a positive post-surgical identity. I then argue that this makes it easy to blame individuals rather than the technology itself when treatment fails. Overall, what I want to suggest is that although obesity surgery is frequently portrayed as a kind of minority freak show, it offers a very unique perspective on the experience of fatness in this context of the war on obesity. So the project that I'm drawing on is an interview-based study that I did in 2005-06, where I interviewed 29 women and 6 men who had undergone obesity surgery. I recruited them through a website, a discussion forum for people that provides support for people either seeking surgery or having surgery. Then I took a kind of discourse analytic approach to the data, exploring what Foucault describes as a tactical polyvalence of discourse. As such, what I'm trying to do here is not pass judgment on what individuals should or should not do with their bodies. That's not a path that I'm interested in going down. I'm more interested in how and with what discursive resources those actions, the decision to have surgery, can be accounted for, and what this can tell us about the experience of surgery. And I've supplemented this with a range of other materials, such as ads and published accounts in books, magazines, by surgeons as well as patients. Okay, so I'm going to start by looking about spectacle. One of the key features that distinguishes obesity surgery within the dominant discourse from the interventions which precede it in the treatment hierarchy is its status as a form of spectacle. This spectacle stems, firstly, from the extreme bodies on which it is generally performed. The bodies of those who have reached extreme levels of obesity are a source of public fascination and spectacle in the media, with a steady stream of television programmes featuring oversized bodies stranded on expansive beds or rippling and uncontained in prurient underwater shots. And I just wanted to show this. This is from a documentary that was on recently called Lose 30 Stone or Die, sensitive to the point of unbelieving. And interesting, lots of the participants that I spoke to in my study commented that no TV programme on obesity surgery is complete without a person underwater. Okay, that there's always the kind of, that because it shows the body rippling in a way that we don't usually see. Accounts of obesity surgery compound this sense of spectacle and our fascinated disgust at the extreme body. And diets, exercise and drugs don't attract this same kind of interest in terms of the television spectacle. A TV blogger described this as fat porn, this kind of focus on surgery. Another of the key differences between surgery and those interventions which precede it is its highly mechanical nature. That is, that it is fundamentally unconcerned with issues of obesity causation or etiology, focusing instead on the prevention of consumption and absorption. This is different, for example, from educational programs which presume that obesity is caused by a lack of understanding of proper nutrition or psychotherapeutic interventions which presume an underlying psychological cause. Similarly, the development of obesity drugs is increasingly targeted at specific brain mechanisms of satiety and craving. In its crudest terms, obesity surgery marks the abandonment of speculation about the causes of overconsumption, providing a mechanical solution which focuses not on the desire to eat, but the ability to do so. This reflects the profound limitations of obesity science to know and control the fat body. In many ways, obesity surgery can be understood as an admission of defeat in this regard. And I mean an admission of defeat for obesity science rather than for the patients, which it often gets cast as. I think Xenical is probably the closest non-surgical example in that it literally prevents the absorption of fat. And many of the people I spoke to actually describe Xenical in very similar terms, because you often lose control of the bowels, which often happens to people who've had surgery as well. The difference is that Xenical is temporary and the withdrawal of medication immediately stops the effect, whereas surgery is pretty much permanent and certainly requires surgical intervention to reverse. Its effects are ongoing. Although, like any surgery, obesity surgery requires a certain level of technical sophistication, skill, and care, it is frequently represented in extremely brutal and low-tech terms, and this is another element of the kind of spectacular nature of surgery. Indeed, the vernacular shorthand for surgery, stomach stapling, invokes this brutal low-tech procedure that's the antithesis of the microscopic cleanliness associated with these more high-tech biomedical fields that we get in the media around genetics and stem cells and microsurgery. This image of obesity surgery is encapsulated in US science journalist Ellen Ruppel-Shell's description of surgeon Ed Munn operating on patient Nancy. And I'll just leave you to read that. Okay, so Shell's description of Nancy's surgery uses the vocabulary of the office, staples, the workshop, rivets and nails, and the kitchen, tablespoons and food. Extending the culinary metaphor, we are told that the intestines are sausage-like. Elsewhere, she describes the smell of the cauterized scalpel cutting through Nancy's flesh as like hamburgers spitting on a grill. The meat analogy is further extended when Munn is described as grasping the end of the small intestine like a rodeo star roping a calf. Nancy's stomach, Shell suggests, has been tamed. It is not, Munn suggests in an understated manner, a delicate solution. In a similar example, US surgeon Norman Ackerman, in his book Fat No More, describes in detail his own procedure for penetrating the layer of abdominal fat, involving him and his assistant bracing themselves against the table and pulling it apart with their hands, a technique which he describes as grotesque but effective. To be clear, I'm not suggesting that obesity surgeons are cavalier in their treatment of their patients, although one cannot help but blanch at the surgeon's comment, that he prefers obesity surgery patients to the breast cancer patients he formerly treated because they put themselves in his hands, they didn't ask a lot of extraneous questions and didn't expect miracles. But what I want to argue is that the very nature of the surgery and the people on whom it's performed lends itself easily to this kind of rhetoric. And as Ed Munn observes in Shell's book, on some levels it's barbaric, but let's face it, it's all we've got. The extremity of obesity surgery, therefore, inadvertently highlights the paucity of safe and effective anti-obesity interventions currently available to doctors and their patients. It is in this sense that obesity surgery can be understood as confessional, a technology of hopelessness. This hopelessness is mitigated to some extent by technological optimism predicting future success. There's the idea that we'll just do this until we get better drugs, until we understand craving, until we understand satiety and so on. But surgery gets positioned as a stopgap, but this is still a stopgap that functions as a commentary on the inadequacy of what's currently available. The status of obesity surgery as a different kind of intervention from those that precede it, alongside this implicit critique of the adequacy of the existing armory of anti-obesity interventions, creates a discursive opportunity for those undergoing surgery to defend themselves against accusations of moral failure that attach very easily to the fat body. The fat body is commonly taken as a metonym for laziness, signifying a lack of self-discipline and control. And those who are fat are widely perceived as simply not trying hard enough. This critique embodies the assumption not only that individuals should lose weight, but that they can, preferably through the morally privileged methods of diet and exercise, with the failure to do so seen as lying with the individuals and not the treatments. As those writers within critical obesity studies, such as Garden Wright, Paul Campos and so on, have highlighted, this distribution of blame and its associated optimism about the effectiveness of the available weight loss strategies are central tenets of the war on obesity. But by discursively constructing obesity as a fundamentally different kind of intervention, the participants in my study were able to position themselves not as refusing to help themselves, but as unable to be helped by the options available prior to surgery. So the key way that this is done was through the detailed cataloguing of a history of weight loss attempts. So Janet, housewife in her 40s, described this eclectic collection of interventions, none of which had been successful. So she's used Reductil, then she said Slimming World, Weight Watchers, the banana and milk diet. She hasn't done the cabbage soup diet, which she thinks is strange because she's tried everything else. and then about doing liquid replacements and so on. This is a very common feature of people's accounts of their weight histories. This listing of prior weight loss attempts serves two key functions for Janet. Firstly, it shows her commitment to weight loss over many years. She's tried. For many of the participants, this was also accompanied with fervent assertions of knowledge about weight loss and sensible eating. As one of the interviewees said, no one knows the way to eat healthily more than an obese person. I could tell you the calorie content of most foods. This was a very common claim. This sets up obesity not as a problem of ignorance or insufficient effort, but rather as one of an innately fat-prone body that is simply not amenable to lifestyle interventions, which are seen as simply not up to the job. So secondly, what Janet does is she jumbles together drugs, crash diets, mainstream commercial programs, and she disrupts this progressive escalation that we see in the NICE guidelines in the NHS delivery system. And she replaces this with two very distinct forms of intervention. There are those that don't work, drugs, diets, etc., and those that do, surgery. So it becomes a very simple choice between the two. This sets up the decision to have surgery not as the avoidance of bodily work or not trying hard enough, but rather as a rational response to repeated failure. So Bill, who was an IT worker, said, I felt I'd tried absolutely everything. There was nothing else to try. Couldn't face doing the same old things again and think they would turn out any differently to the other times. Surgery then is posited as an intervention of a different order, one which was proportionate to the problems that they faced, unlike all the things they'd tried previously. Indeed, for many of the participants, surgery was an entirely new beginning. And on the website discussion forums, the date of surgery was referred to as their rebirth date. Members were congratulated on their surgery day and on subsequent surgery anniversaries with the words, "Happy Rebirth Day." It is in this sense that obesity surgery is a technology of hope. But this assertion of surgery as an intervention which is fundamentally different in scale and substance from the conventional diet and exercise interventions always risks being read by others as trying to opt out of bodily work, rendering the reborn self always potentially inauthentic, so effectively you're cheating. For many participants, this was addressed by positioning surgery as normalising the body, making it ready to perform the normative bodily work, what Fiona, an office worker in her 30s, described as being able to, quote, diet like a normal person. This makes sense in the contemporary social and cultural context of the war on obesity and health discourse more generally, where the body is constantly to be worked upon and is never finished or to be left to its own devices. Obesity surgery here is not a resolution in itself, but a first step, a tool, a construction which leaves the work of weight loss and maintenance with the individual, not the surgery. As the founder of the online organisation, Ken, whose picture I showed you earlier, he told me in a letter that life is a challenge, but as for most people, maintaining energy intake output equation whilst balancing a busy life is difficult. I'm at least in with a chance to take part, and this is what surgery is seen as providing. Okay, it enables individuals to work at exercising the normatively determined self-surveillance and discipline of the body. In this way, the participants were able to define themselves not as the repudiated objects of the war on obesity, its targets, but as its dedicated subjects, newly enabled by surgery. But while this led them to minimise the role of surgery to some extent in order to exaggerate their own role in the process, at certain moments they really emphasised the more spectacular elements of surgery quite strategically and primarily as a means of emphasising the commitment to losing weight. It's a kind of see what I was prepared to do in order to lose weight. This also shows just how different surgery is seen as being. It's a completely different step. And the most striking form this took, was the displaying in the interview of abdominal scarring. Because many of the surgeries leave a scar basically from the breastbone down to the pubic bone. And sooner or later, most of the interviews I did were brought to a halt by the participants whipping up their tops and showing me the scars. This kind of... I don't know if you can see this image, but this is what this woman is doing, actually, that she's showing her scar. She's rolled her top up and is kind of quite proudly displaying it. So this is a very common thing. So what they're doing, it's a kind of literal badge of honour, a literal mark of the lengths that they've gone to. Others talked about their pride at having taken such a bold and step that was felt as being quite empowering, often in the face of resistance from doctors and family members who constantly reiterated risk and that they should go on a diet or exercise more. And so the decision to undergo surgery is positioned as a new acceptance of responsibility, an empowering acceptance of responsibility that puts them within the discourse of the war on obesity, even while it's rejecting the feasibility of the preferred and morally privileged methods of the war on obesity, i.e. diet and exercise. So it's doing those two things, rejecting what hasn't worked, but still claiming the moral kind of benefits. And the fact that this discursive work is necessary tells us something about the way we see people who are very fat. This is a very defensive act because they are constantly attacked and accused. Obesity surgery then can be understood as both a technology of hope and of hopelessness. As a technology of hope, it offers the possibility of socially valued and greatly desired bodily transformation that is proved absolutely unattainable and sustainable by any other means. However, the fact that participants had to resort to surgery in the first place highlights the current inadequacies of the interventions available to individuals to facilitate weight loss. This is the hopelessness. Obesity surgery, therefore, can be seen as reinforcing the ideology of the war on obesity by emphasising the importance of weight loss, of bodily work, and the unacceptability of the fat body ultimately, but as simultaneously challenging its claims to the efficacy of its favoured methods. A construction which relies on the separation out of surgery as the single method that works, the one that offers the hope. But in this final part of my paper, what I want to look at is what happens to these discourses of hope and hopelessness when surgery goes wrong, when it doesn't work. I want to suggest that the very aspects of surgery that mark it out as different serve to insulate it from blame. And so what this does is enables surgery to retain its position and its kind of status as a technology of hope, as a very positive technology, whilst transferring failure and responsibility to the individuals who engage with it. So it turns back on them very quickly. Excuse me. So one of the key elements of surgery that marks it out as different, as a different kind of intervention, is its riskiness, and perhaps more pertinently, a risk calculation that reduces surgery to a choice between surgery or death. Indeed, this is central to the spectacular nature of obesity surgery. It's supposed to be dangerous. It's part of the attraction of these programs. Those who are medically categorized as obese or morbidly obese are repeatedly told by doctors that they will die if they do not lose weight. They'll die in 3 years, they'll die in 5 years. People are always being given these deadlines. This is exemplified by this article here from January 2007, which offered the story of Victoria, a 27-year-old woman who had experienced incremental weight gain in spite of repeated and sustained efforts to diet. The crunch came during a consultation with an obesity surgeon who told her, "It's not good news. You weigh 26 stone and I'm afraid you're likely to be dead before you reach 30. In the narrative, Victoria reflects, "I'd been given a death sentence." As the magazine cover suggests, the decision to undergo surgery has become a zero-sum game of diet or die. Participants in my research repeated this certainty about their own futures almost ubiquitously, with even those who were well describing them in terms of the familiar rhetoric of the ticking time bomb, a life-threatening crisis waiting to happen. So in this sense, they're figured in the decision to have surgery as having nothing to lose and everything to gain. The rhetoric of do or die was never made more explicit to me than, I don't know if anyone saw this, that than in the recent, extremely sensationalist and really quite offensive, Channel 4 documentary Half Ton Mum. The story of 29-year-old American woman, Renee Williams, this woman here, mother of two, who underwent surgery after years of disabling and extreme obesity. Renee was given a year to live, diet or die, even though her surgeon acknowledged that she didn't suffer from any of the illnesses commonly associated with obesity, such as diabetes, high blood pressure. She was actually quite well, and there's no basis given for the determination that she's got a year to live. We're just told that she has. The documentary is upbeat in tone, and Renee is celebrated as a role model for those experiencing extreme obesity, as someone who is taking action and finally getting the surgery needs. And this is exactly the same discourse that the participants in my study, who were generally much smaller than this, used, that it's a kind of new start, you're getting on and doing something. It's not until we are two-thirds through the way of the programme, that we discover that Renee died 12 days after her surgery. But this isn't allowed to interfere with the programme's upbeat message. After all, we're told, she lost 4 stone, which shows that the surgery was a success. And she's cited as an inspiration for other housebound victims to seek out surgery. The programme ends with a montage of walls being chiselled out of homes to facilitate the removal of people too immobilised by size to pass through doorways. The voiceover tells us that they have been encouraged and inspired by Renee's story. Her death seems to make little difference, and I couldn't help but wonder if her doctors and the documentary makers were not treating her, even when she was alive, as if she were already dead, and indeed had nothing to lose. From this perspective, surgery can be seen, and particularly in this very extreme case, can be seen as the absolute apotheosis of the war on obesity, where the fat body is never acceptable. Significantly, in the documentary, it is Renee's body weight rather than the surgery that is held responsible for her death. Surgery is judged to have come too late to save her from fatness, even though her death occurred so close to surgery that it's hard to believe that it had no part to play. Ironically then, the treatment for fatness failed to save her because she was fat. A tricky catch-22 from a patient perspective.
Sorry, you said she lost 4 stone before she died?
Yeah.
Was that in 12 days?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So we've got this kind of catch-22 where people, it fails because they're fat, but that's what they're being treated for. So I'm just going to move on from that. Other post-surgical problems that the patients in my study experience were also accounted for not as surgical failures, but as bodily idiosyncrasies. Julia, for example, had endured repeated and often debilitating vomiting post-surgery due to an excessively narrowed exit from the stomach pouch, but assured me, it's not his fault, referring to her surgeon, it's my body. The elective nature of surgery also exposes individuals to the criticism and blame of others. For example, many of the participants reported incidences of family members losing patience with some of the more... Some of the more antisocial side effects of surgery. So this is Judith, and she said, I was having problems being sick, I was making unpleasant noises, burping, this, that, and the other. And he, her husband, got very annoyed one day and said, it's unnatural, you shouldn't have had it done. Similarly, following an unfortunate incident in a restaurant garden where she had run into the bushes to be sick, Jennifer's husband demanded angrily, what have you done to yourself? This produces surgery and its problems as something that people do to themselves, transferring responsibility directly onto them for the outcomes and insulating the surgery itself from blame. And the same happens with weight gain. When people gain weight, they are deemed to not be eating properly, rather than the surgery not having worked. So this is another cyclical explanation where the inability to control consumption is treated with surgery, which is seen as having failed because of the inability to control consumption. This recalls my earlier work on IVF, which is another technology of hope, where the failure of fertility treatment is routinely accounted for by the fact that those being treated have fertility problems. So in a sense, because of the mechanical nature of obesity surgery, its job is seen to be done once the surgery is finished. It's reduced stomach capacity and intestinal length, and no more can be asked of it. Furthermore, given the emphasis that was placed by the participants in my study on surgery as a tool which enabled them to do the work of weight management, it's perhaps inevitable that it's the patients and not the surgery that gets the blame. This reproduces the discourse of individual failure to discipline the body that those engaging with weight loss interventions routinely experience, eroding the carefully established and discursively useful distance between surgery and the interventions which precede it in the treatment hierarchy. So to conclude, I began this paper by asking what kind of intervention obesity surgery is and what its relationship to the war on obesity is. In the paper, I've argued that although obesity surgery is incorporated as one of a wide panoply of anti-obesity interventions, and this is part of our mainstream provision now, and it is undoubtedly produced by and reproduces the core values of the war on obesity, it is a very different kind of intervention from those which precede it in the hierarchy because of its spectacular nature, its mechanistic disregard for issues of causation, and because of its higher levels of risk. I have suggested that these features enable patients to position themselves as taking bold action against obesity, of accepting the work of disciplining the body, and of accepting risk in the hope of achieving the socially valued and desired bodily transformation and, by extension, avoiding premature morbidity and mortality. I've argued that these features position surgery as a technology of hope for those engaging with it and can be mobilised discursively to establish a positive post-surgical identity. These same features also necessarily highlight the inadequacies of other less interventionist and risky anti-obesity strategies. This locates surgery as a technology of hopelessness, as an intervention which is used by a tiny minority of those who are overweight and obese, but which testifies to the inadequacies of the interventions to which the majority are subjected and which have documentedly low success rates across the board. But I've also argued that when obesity surgery fails, either because of death, complications, or weight gain, and I should add that for the participants, weight gain was considered to be by far the worst, the most frightening of the failures, blame falls to the patients and not the technology. It falls to fatness and those who are fat rather than the treatment itself. This highlights the extent to which surgery, whilst constituting an intervention of a very different order to those which precede it in the treatment hierarchy, is ultimately inseparable from them as part of a war on obesity which routinely positions individuals as morally culpable for their size and its consequences. This is not to argue that people should not engage with obesity surgery, but rather, I think it highlights the fact that although it remains a minority intervention, it offers a useful and important commentary on the wider context of the war on obesity, whether it works or not. Thank you very much.